Okay, so it looks like we've got both attorneys here for the final case on our oral argument calendar this morning. As you're settling in, I will call the case. The next case is State of Minnesota versus Rosario Martinez Jr. The case number is A231011. And counsel, welcome to the Court of Appeals. It's nice to see you both today. Just a few words before you begin your arguments. Counsel for the appellant will have 15 minutes. Counsel for respondent will have 15 minutes, and then appellant's counsel will have a 5-minute rebuttal opportunity. The lectern in the middle goes up and down. Please feel free to adjust it to your comfort level, and we'll wait for you to get settled before we hear from you. And then finally, please just make sure you introduce yourself and the party you're representing before you begin your argument, just because we're making an audio recording of the argument this morning, and that will help keep a clear record for us. Are you ready? Okay, you may proceed.
And may it please the court, counsel. My name is Charles Clippert. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Martinez. And the facts of the case are actually fairly simple. It's a kind of a run-of-the-mill DWI stop. The arresting officer does some field sobriety tests. Mr. Martinez is maybe a little resistant and doesn't quite do them very well. He gets arrested. The officer gets a search warrant, and my client declines to provide a blood or urine test. And what I'd like to do is talk to you, I think the second issue in my brief relating to Exhibit 5 is maybe perhaps a bit more novel than the issue with the jury instruction and maybe a good place to start.
You know, I really want to talk about that second issue, but I have a quick question as to the first issue that I want to make sure that we cover, with your indulgence. So, the conviction here in this case was a refusal to provide a blood or urine sample pursuant to a search warrant. So, a judge had already found probable cause, and the instructional error that you're alleging concerns the trial court's instruction as to what probable cause is. Does that even matter given the fact that we had a warrant here?
And it's actually an interesting question, and I don't know that it's necessarily fully before the court, but I also think if my client's entitled to a jury trial on all the elements of the offense and all the all the essential elements, I don't think if you say to the court, to a jury, hey, a judge already found probable cause, you know, that's not an issue before this court. You're directing a verdict on an element of the offense.
Well, does the probable cause standard even enter into it?
Well, it does, because in, you know, copying all the other cases discussing probable cause, that's an issue that has to go before the jury. So it is, it's still a jury question. The fact that a judge in a Fourth Amendment context found probable cause does not necessarily mean that the prosecutor during a jury trial process, you know, where there's cross-examination and more of a adversarial system, has proven beyond a reasonable doubt that the officer had probable cause.
Okay, so it's your position that notwithstanding the statutory change and the requirement for a search warrant and the nature of the conviction here, the state still had to prove as an element of the offense that the officer had probable cause to request a blood or urine sample.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Just jumping ahead to the second issue, and I probably should have attached Exhibit 5 to my brief, but it's this sheet of paper that's captioned State Summary of Evidence Pursuant to Minnesota Rule of Evidence 106 or 1006. I started my career as a public defender in one of the metro counties and did that for 10 years and been doing this for a while. I've never seen anything like this before.
Me
in any
neither.
kind
I've
of
never heard
proceeding.
I've never heard of Rule 1006. So maybe you can tell us what Rule 1006 is typically used for by way of background.
So my experience, Rule 1006 is used when you have a mountain of cell phone data, for example. So the cell phone data is actually admitted, and then someone from the BCA comes out and says, Well, using, the latitude and longitude that shows this guy drove up and down this, up and down I-35, and is presented in a summary fashion that way, because I think if you were to look at each cell phone tower connection, a jury's going to look at that and go, what? So the summary here is much more, that's the most common way I've ever seen it used. I've never seen it used
Well, it's very
like
common in
this.
civil cases
Yes.
for recording, multiple business records that say the same thing to create a summary instead of the jury having to look through all of
Right.
the business records.
There's, I think, four cases that deal with this rule that when I looked at it on Westlaw, and two of them were accountants, you talking about voluminous bank records to show fraud or whatever it was. So it's very rarely used in a criminal proceeding. And what's kind of what is sort of really bothering me about rule or exhibit five is there's just nothing. This was typed up by their office, the Steele County
Well,
Attorney's
do we
office.
even know who the declarant was here?
No.
We have no idea.
No. There's no, this Ms. LeMay woman, the paralegal testifies that it's an accurate summary of my client's criminal record, but it doesn't say whether it's a certified criminal records, whether it's a register of actions, whether it's a sentencing judgment. I've seen these come in where you do a summary and then you put a court exhibit in that summarize, that is the summary is a summary of the court exhibit that had would have the certified copies or something to support what the document is, but we just have nothing here. It's unusual. And what's difficult or I think challenging about this exhibit five is it's the only evidence of our client's priors. There's some, if you listen to the body-worn camera video on exhibit two, there is some mention that, hey, he's got some priors, he refused a DMT, but there's nothing, suggesting that there's a conviction and it's within 10 years. So this is the only evidence that's offered by the state to prove this element of the offense.
The
And
state is arguing that this is akin to the DPS records discussed in the 2018 Noor decision. I think you're suggesting this is actually more of a Caulfield situation. What's your best pitch as to how this falls more into that category of records that are not business records but are testimonial evidence.
and in Noor, it was actually, I think, saved because there was this cover letter that went out saying, hey, this is a record that we send out or mail out in the regular course of business. Here, there's just the paralegal comes in and says, I got 80 pages of documents, court records. Boy, that seems like that's too much for a court to consider. So I question whether there's a foundation for Rule 1006 to even apply, because sounds like 8 pages are the sentencing order. And this is testimonial. It's prepared for litigation. It's got a caption. It's got the court file number on it. It clearly is prepared for litigation. And I think when you look at the paralegal's testimony, it is, does that document accurately summarize the court records for both criminal convictions that you obtained for the case? So the criminal convictions were obtained for the case. This document was prepared to try and accurately summarize the court documents. So it's testimonial. It's prepared for litigation.
If
And
she had testified that she prepared the document, would your analysis be different?
gets better. It would be better if she said, I prepared this document after reviewing certified convictions of his criminal record. That
It's
would
not
make
your
it better.
argument that you could never use this rule. It's the way that this rule has been applied in this case is your
Right,
concern.
right. And I think for this, the summary to apply, for the evidence in the summary to be admitted, they've got to be admissible in themselves. So the comments to the rule say the evidence doesn't have to be admitted, but I think the evidence has to be admissible, or otherwise you risk backdooring inadmissible evidence and into a summary, and I don't think that's the
Indeed, wouldn't your argument be a lot more challenging if she had testified? I reviewed the records. They're certified copies of the convictions. There are two convictions under, the two different statutes. You wouldn't have a confrontation problem then, would you?
I would have, right. I think if she's testifying about the contents of certified copies of the criminal records, it makes my argument a lot harder.
And speaking of the confrontation clause, there's no objection made on the basis of the confrontation clause. Do you concede that you're in plain error review here on that issue?
I don't.
And why not?
Because we, as a court, we have general objections, and I think if the nature of the objection's clear, you don't even have to state the objection. And I think it's clear here that this is a confrontation clause violation. I know
Well,
that
it
there's.
sounds a little bit like you're rephrasing a plain error standard of review there. If it's obvious, you don't have to state the basis. That sounds like plain error review to me.
I guess if the court does say, okay, there's a waiver of the confrontation clause issue, it's still pretty clearly hearsay, statement coming in to prove the truth of the matter asserted. So I think if the court doesn't want to consider the confrontation clause, there's still the hearsay issue, which I think is we prevail under as well. The respondent seemed
But
to.
isn't, I mean, the whole purpose of Rule 1006 is to, I think that if it appropriately complies with the rule, that then it's an exception to the hearsay rule. I mean, I think that's how it works in civil land.
Sure.
And so I think that the hearsay analysis is a little more complicated, because I think the purpose of this rule is to allow for the district court or the jury to get evidence in a way that is more easily digestible when they are hearsay statements, they are out of court statements, which is I think what makes the confrontation clause issue maybe the stronger of the two, given the what the purpose of Rule 1006 is.
Right. And I guess it goes back to this whole idea that typically it's a voluminous business records that are getting summarized, and the records would be admissible as a business record exception. So, but here there's no exception that says someone in the prosecutor's office gets to type up a document in it.
Well,
And
but aren't those? Oh, go ahead. Well, to me, this role, which I'm not familiar with, looks more like a role that would be invoked if there was a stipulation by the parties to, not bring in a pile of documents. And so, in your review of the very limited law out there, does it suggest that this is typically something everybody's sort of in agreement with?
yeah, I think that's usually how it is because, again, like on the civil side, if you're going to have a trial and it's accounting records that no one really disputes, it's easier just to do a summary and everyone just stipulates. And I think with DWIs, the typical practice is that people do stipulate. So I'm not sure whether the prosecutor's office was caught a little flat-footed because there wasn't a stipulation. I'm not sure, but the summary doesn't seem to be the appropriate way to bring in those prior convictions. Because of the various.
Can you just tell me how this would normally happen? Would it normally happen that the state would offer the certified sentencing records? Is that, if this isn't conceded in a trial, what's the normal way that the state would
Yeah,
prove
normally
that?
the prosecutor comes in with certified copies of the convictions. I've not seen the.
Which are not hearsay because they're certified documents.
Correct. And I've not seen them use complaints because I think complaints brings up other issues about confrontation clause and what's mentioned in the complaints. The register of actions can be a little dodgy because I've seen mistakes in the re registers of action. So the best way, the safest way, is to bring that certified copy of the conviction in. And honestly, that
Which
may.
aren't hearsay. So if that was the basis for creating this document, then it would be more like a business record where the underlying document was not hearsay, and it's a summary of documents that would have been otherwise admissible. So your concern here is that there's not testimony that's showing, one, who created the document, and two, that the documents that were used to prepare the document would have been otherwise admissible under the hearsay
Yeah,
exceptions.
exactly. Correct. And had the foundation for the document, again, Ben, I reviewed certified copies of the convictions. These are fair and accurate copies of those or summaries of those certified copies, then I'm in a much more difficult situation, I think. So, Your Honor, unless there's any more questions, I'd just ask the court to consider the submissions and reverse Mr. Martinez's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And next, we will hear from counsel for respondent. Take your time.
Thank you, Your Honor, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name's Campbell Hausch. I'm an assistant Steele County attorney. I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota. I was just going to go through briefly all the issues and sub-issues in the case, but I have a feeling the court might just want to cut to the heart of it. I'd be fine with that.
Well, I have the same concern on the first issue that I'd like to hear your perspective on that issue, because both questions are before the court, and that is, given the nature of the conviction here under subdivision 2 clause 2 of the refusal statute, was an instruction defining probable cause even necessary in this case, given that there was a search warrant for the appellant's blood or urine?
I think there's certainly a great argument that it is not. And I think the state would be more than fine if this court decided that and made that clear for refusal cases like this. Given that, again, the determination was made already. So the jigs are a little, they don't differentiate as clearly on when you're dealing with breath or blood refusals on whether you need that. So I got a little bit of a loss myself, but wanted to be on the safer side.
And did you forfeit that issue by not arguing it in your brief?
I don't believe so. I mean, I think the court could analyze the instruction that way that the court's suggesting, but I don't know.
Thank you.
If we determine that there was error by the court, and I'm following up on Mr. Clifford's closing remark, he's asking for a reversal. Is there room for a reversal and a remand, particularly on the summary of documents? Do you get a second bite at the apple?
I believe so, Your Honor. I think that there is room there. I think it's, what the appellant seems to be seeking is, just the...
Perhaps you'd rather argue that it's error, but it's harmless error.
Certainly, yes. Yeah. So I think if the court were to find a confrontation clause violation, is that what the court is asking about the confrontation clause violation? Yes, I mean, the state would, propose that, the error was harmless. But honestly, if the court goes to the confrontation clause violation, I don't know if it would survive if that's how the court gets at it. I was assuming that if the main determination would be whether this was competent 1006 evidence, because I believe there's not a confrontation clause issue if this court determines that it was not an abuse of discretion to allow the summary evidence in, just given the fact that what was summarized, those documents are certified records and wouldn't be the kinds of documents that are testimonial and that wouldn't apply.
Well, I think appellant's argument is that the state failed to make the appropriate record, that the basis for this document was certified documents that would have been otherwise admissible, and they also failed to present evidence of the person who actually had prepared the document, and that's what makes it a confrontation clause issue, and that's what makes this not about whether you can use this rule in this manner. It's that the state has failed to make the record that they needed to make.
That's certainly possible. In hindsight, after hearing this court's questions, I
have kind of a silly question, but it goes back to trial experience. Don't you have an obligation to share your exhibits with defense counsel prior to the trial? And if so, why wasn't there a motion to the court to have this, to argue this, to argue the voluminous nature of the document and the need for a summary? Why didn't that happen?
It did happen, Your Honor. There was notice of this, and it was actually mentioned on page 4 of the transcript. I laid out that Ms. LeMay is going to testify to a summary of 2 certified convictions.
This is before trial?
It's in the before, at the very beginning of trial.
Go ahead, because I'm not familiar with that part of the record.
Sure, and I had provided the document, or shown the document to counsel, and I had the certified records as well in court, and they, you know, those were disclosed with defense. Not that that matters. I know that's not what the court's asking, but...
So continue with the transcript, though. And I'll check the record, yeah, too. I'm just not familiar with what you're reciting.
Sure. So it's on page 4 of the transcript. I laid out that it was going to be pursuant to Minnesota Rule of Evidence 1006. That was disclosed to defense. So that
time you indicated to defense that you had certified copies?
Yeah, those certified copies were shared as part of the discovery process that had been requested.
So then what happened when you made that announcement?
There was no note or objection to that.
So I read that part of the record, and you said, I'm going to do this. I'm going to submit this summary. Defense counsel said nothing. It kind of got lost in the shuffle then, because you were also discussing the jury instructions, right?
Correct.
And so there was no objection to the exhibit until it was offered through the testimony of the witness LeMay, right?
That's correct. And the court is probably familiar with this as well, but on page 176, the objection was very specifically on hearsay grounds. So I think this court's question is accurate, that if the court reaches the confrontation clause,
well, which would have made sense, because that's when you would object, is when the witness is up there and you are trying to get the exhibit admitted, and the question is, have you laid the appropriate foundation to get this in under Rule 1006 or not? I mean, that would be the appropriate time to make that objection, because up until that time, defense counsel doesn't know what the person that you've brought to testify about this is going to testify to, or how this document was created.
And I'm sorry, I was very poorly phrased. I only brought that up just to talk about the standard of review, that it should be the confrontation clause issue should be reviewed under plain error analysis, because the objection was not clearly.
Now I'm getting confused. The objection, and I understand the record, the objection at the time that it was coming in through LeMay, that was hearsay, and it was not based on a summary. It wasn't based on the type of document. It was based on a hearsay objection.
Correct. And that's object on hearsay grounds, I believe, is what was said.
And did the confrontation provision come up?
I believe in briefs. I don't believe it ever came up at trial.
I mean, at trial. So the objection was purely a hearsay objection.
Correct. And I believe, according to the Rosberg case that I mentioned in my brief on page 4, as well as what it cites, which is the Brown case, 792 Northwest 2nd, 815, that it's clear from those two cases that, you know, when there's a very specific objection made, it's what appellant is suggesting, that, you know, it was apparent from the context is not there, and it should still be analyzed under the plain error standard.
So let's just assume that we are in plain error territory, you know, and that's the standard of review that applies to the constitutional argument, the confrontation argument that's been raised. Would you agree that that this is clearly testimonial evidence?
I wouldn't, Your Honor. I think it would have been cleaner. If, as the court has mentioned, if Ms. LeMay had included the word certified convictions, if there's more of a record on that, which I think has been brought up by the court.
But would you agree that this document was prepared for the trial?
It was. I guess what I'm resting on is the fact that if the court believes it's was properly admitted as summary evidence, then the conceptual thing I'm trying to get at would be that what it summarizes, of course, it is a statement. It's a typed in the syntactically a statement, but it is by the very nature of any summary, what it is representing is the documents that it summarizes, which were those themselves being certified court documents were admissible.
Were those other documents sent to the jury?
Those were not. It, as this court has kind of figured out, the stipulation wasn't, or the lack of a stipulation, which is a very atypical in a DWI case like this, as the court knows, was anticipated to some extent. It was the state's, the main reason the state did this was to reduce the kind of, prejudice that may come from the jury seeing the sentences and the details that are even in a sentencing document. Although, again, because of the lack of the stipulation, it's also the state's position. The state could have offered more documents than just the sentencing order to prove up the element, and which would have even given maybe more information that, could have been prejudicial. So this is the way the state, I guess, chose to do it.
So you thought you were removing from the jury's consideration anything in those court records that your office received that might actually kind of backfire and prejudice the appellant in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. And I mean, depending on what was introduced and the objections made, I wouldn't be surprised if we would have been here anyway. So just because it was, again, I have very limited practice, but I think it's rare to have a lack of stipulation for DWIs.
But just, I mean, going back to whether this is prepared for litigation, I mean, I think the point that Judge Gaitis is trying to make is because even if the document itself was relying on documents that were otherwise admissible, the fact that it was made by a person in preparation for litigation, did that obligate the state to put the person on the stand who created the document so that the defendant had an opportunity to cross-examine them about the creation of the document since they were the, despite where the underlying evidence came, was there a constitutional obligation to put the person on the stand who created the document? I guess that's maybe the city.
I can see why the court is asking that. I mean, I would argue no if the court believes rules that there was not an abuse of discretion to let it in under the summary rule. It would have been me on the stand. I prepared it, not the paralegal, just to answer. I know everyone's wondering. So I
was wondering if you were going to admit that you were the one who would.
Yes, I did. And so, but I would still say that, again, I believe the summary was accurate. And I don't believe it's the kind of document, if you look at the, I know the case that was mentioned, the factors that you usually look at, I do believe it's more of analogous to the Knorr case. I know it's not perfect, but if the conception gets there that the document is a summary, summarizes the certified documents, then I think it can get there. So I don't have much more on it other than, the document is itself, if you don't consider it a summary, it was absolutely prepared for litigation as an exhibit, but I think the statement as a summary is not the kind of testimonial statement that the Confrontation Clause applies to at all. The statement is that he's been convicted of these crimes. It was based on court records that if
except that the convictions are an element of the offense. I mean, I think that's the problem.
And I think the statute that appellant cited that lets these convictions be proven by any competent and reliable evidence is covered by the unconventional way the state responded to an unconventional lack of stipulation. So I think Ms. LeMay's testimony in combination with the document, unless this court, just rules it's a Confrontation Clause violation, plain error, is competent and reliable evidence. And the jury clearly thought so. And it got in, and I guess that's where we're at. So at this time, I'd just rest on my brief. I guess I'll use my last part of the time here to just say that as far as the probable cause instruction, I do believe appellant's correct. Copy definitely controls. There's very limited law on this. I mean, this court definitely has the opportunity to, I guess, expand that if this court wants to. But I do believe that the instruction by the district court judge is, while similar length, very different, and very much does get to all three issues in copy, both letting it be more objective, limiting, you know, the ability to consider the officer's subjective belief. And so I believe it's not an abuse of discretion to, and not a material misstatement of the law. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Everyone says this, I'll be quick and I will. I just, on the jury instruction on the probable cause, the biggest error is actually an honest and strong belief is not necessarily a reasonable belief. And I think that's what the jury instruction given by the district court goes farthest astray. And I think that's one of the important things about copy is it's got to be checked through a reasonable officer. And I hate to throw politics into this, but we just came out of the pandemic and there's people that honestly and strongly believe both sides of a, and whatever the, did we get the vaccines? You know, obviously that was very divisive and people honestly and strongly believed their positions, but that doesn't make them reasonable. So, and especially if you mean honestly, meaning heartfelt. So I think the instruction here does diminish the probable cause standard because it does not require the jury to consider a reasonable officer's beliefs. So so we'd ask the court to consider that and reverse his convictions. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. The case is now submitted to the court and we will issue our decision within the next 90 days. And this case concludes our oral calendar this morning. So we will now retire to consider the other matters before us. Thanks.